Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Alison Armstrong, who is a mindfulness teacher and researcher and founder of Present Minds. She's going to talk to us today about mindfulness and compulsive buying, which began as the research project for her PhD and became a groundbreaking results study. And she's also going to say how this might relate to the middle way. Hello, Alison. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry.
Well, could you maybe start off, Alison, by telling us a little bit about your background?
Yes, certainly. My first degree was actually in maths with engineering, and then I spent 10 years working in engineering-related roles, increasingly becoming dissatisfied with feeling at home in that world, but also increasingly becoming aware of the sustainability issues and the environmental issues that we face. So I decided to leave engineering. Well, my original plan wasn't to leave engineering, but I went and did a master's in sustainability at the University of Surrey. And my aim was to go back into engineering, but with a different focus. But I had already trained as a yoga teacher. I already had a strong yoga and meditation practice. And it was while doing my master's that I... two things happened. First of all, I came across the work of Tim Jackson and felt very inspired by the behavioral side to sustainability. And secondly, decided it was an opportunity to indulge a passion and an interest, which was to look at the role or the possible connections between consumerism and spirituality, which was partly motivated by my own experience. I'd felt that the more I had practiced yoga and done meditation, the more I had personally felt less and less like I wanted to engage in consumerist activities. And I wanted to see whether that was kind of normal, whether other people had experienced that. So that's what I did for my master's thesis and worked with Tim Jackson on that project, and was very fortunate that at the end of that he had a funded PhD that enabled me to go on and continue studying that. But I chose to study consumerism in relation to mindfulness rather than spirituality, and that may be a different discussion of the relationship between spirituality and mindfulness, but that was what I chose as my focus for my PhD.
And why did you think that would be a useful connection to make between those two?
Well, having already studied consumerism and spirituality, I felt that there was a connection there. And to me, mindfulness is a spiritual practice. However, mindfulness also has the benefit that it has been, if you like, extracted from its spiritual home and has become a secular practice as well, which means that it feels like that makes it more interesting and accessible maybe to the current society that we have. And so it was really a sort of journey between looking at those elements.
Okay. So in your research, was there a specific aspect of compulsive buying that you focused on?
Well, I decided to study compulsive buying partly because a PhD requires you to narrow down your point of focus quite significantly. And the way that I see compulsive buying is that it's on a spectrum with so-called normal buying. Yeah. And so if we want to understand our consumer behavior for all of us, then actually we can learn a lot by studying an extreme end of that. Yeah. So that was why I chose compulsive buying, and I focused on mainly studying people who were self-confessed compulsive buyers. So they recognized it in themselves. They were at a point in their addiction where they were no longer in denial about it. They recognized it, and they identified with it, and those were the people that I recruited into my study.
Okay, and does a compulsive buyer in general terms fit a certain profile?
In some ways, yes. I hesitate because we kind of all have this image that if you're a shopping addict, you're young and female. And certainly you do get people. There is a peak in compulsive buying behavior in the late teens and early 20s. So in terms of age, that would be true. But it's not capturing the whole picture, because I had people in my study who were in their 20s, but people in their 60s as well. And I had I only had one man taking part, but nonetheless, I did have a man involved. And what's interesting is that a lot of the studies show that compulsive buying does occur more for women than for men. But if you look at the way that those studies have recruited their participants, they quite often have a bias in terms of they recruit through women's magazines, for example. So, of course, they'll get more women than men. So and there's also an interesting thing about labeling. If we label it as shopping addiction, we're going to attract women to our studies. But if we call it, for example, collecting, then we're going to attract more men into the study. So there's an interesting thing around labeling and recruitment that means it can be a little difficult to know exactly what a typical compulsive buyer is. But I think from what I've seen, I would generally say that it does occur more for women than for men. And that if it's not resolved when someone's in their 20s, then it can very easily last for 20, 30, 40 years. So it can be a very long-term addiction.
But does that often resolve itself naturally? You say it tends to affect young women and young men. Do they often grow out of it, or is it because this research is relatively new? Do you think more and more people will not grow out of it because a lot of them are young, if that makes sense?
Yes, it's very hard to say. We don't have that much data on it. My sense is that if we liken it, for example, to excessive alcohol consumption, then we know that people, for example, in their student days at university, they're likely to have a much higher level of alcohol consumption. And then gradually, as they get older, that will reduce, although for some it will never reduce and it will turn into an addiction. So we can kind of formulate that same kind of view of shopping addiction. And what's also interesting is that, and we may well come on to this, shopping addiction or compulsive buying is often triggered by a lack of clarity over our sense of identity. There are lots of identity drivers in triggering shopping, this kind of shopping. And when you think about the way that our identities form, when we're in our late teens and early 20s, we still have quite often quite an insecure sense of identity. So as that becomes clearer as we get older, then our need to use shopping in that way may well reduce. But that's kind of me hypothesizing a little bit, because we don't have an awful lot of information or empirical work to support that.
Okay. Do you think it's a first world phenomenon?
Certainly in the scale that we see it, I would say so. And that's really because we need to have certain structural things in place to support it. So we need to have easy access to credit, for example. And if that's not available, then even if somebody has the tendency towards being a compulsive buyer, if they don't have the cash, they simply can't do that. Yeah. We certainly see examples of excessive and compulsive buying in other countries, other parts of the world, in the developing world, but it tends to be within the wealthy elite rather than within kind of the general population.
That makes sense. Yeah. Okay, so for the uninitiated listener, what is mindfulness?
Mindfulness has its roots in Buddhism, but it has its roots in other religions too. And it is primarily a way of being in the present moment. So we practice experiencing what's happening to us and what's happening in our immediate environment in that moment, and doing that ideally with a in a non-judgmental way. So, for example, if we're not living in the present moment, then there's only two other places we can be, and we'll either be going over what's happened in the past or we'll be projecting forwards into the future. And neither of which are necessarily problematic in their own right, but they can be problematic. So, for example, a healthy way of living in the past, for example, might be we meet up with an old friend and we're reminiscing about things that are past, and that can be really pleasant. But if our relationship with the past tends to be very negative, very much sort of self-blaming for things that have happened in our lives, then that can lead to depression or to depression-type symptoms. And likewise, if we're thinking about the future, well, we have to do a certain amount of planning for the future, otherwise we won't have a retirement fund when we retire and we won't go on holidays. So we have to plan. But again, if we're too much living in the future, or if our relationship to the future is very negative, then that will lead to worry, to anxiety, and so on. So with mindfulness, what we're doing is we're raising our awareness, first of all, so that we are aware of what's happening in the present moment, or we're aware of when we're not in the present moment. And then we can have a choice over whether we return to the present moment and to what's happening with our mind, our emotions and our body in that present moment.
Okay, that's great. So how did you set up the research then, Alison, for the project?
Well, the study with the compulsive bias was the third of three studies I did for the PhD. So I'll focus on that one.
Yeah.
I basically recruited a group of compulsive buyers, as I said earlier, self-confessed, so they recognized in themselves that they had this issue in their lives. I asked them to fill out a questionnaire, and I also interviewed them because I was very interested in what their experience was of being a compulsive buyer.
Yeah.
They then went through the standard mindfulness-based stress reduction training, which takes place over 8 weeks. It involves 2 hours a week in a group setting with a teacher, but also daily home practice of the mindfulness meditations. And then at the end of that, they completed the same questionnaire, and I interviewed them again to see what their experience had been of the course. And then I went back to them again a third time 3 months later. So they filled out the questionnaire a third time and I interviewed them a third time in order to capture at least a little bit what the longer term effects were of the mindfulness training. I had two other groups involved in the study. One was a group of compulsive buyers who didn't do the mindfulness training, and they filled out the questionnaire at the same three time points. And then I had a group of so-called normal buyers, as in they did not have a compulsive buying issue, and they completed the mindfulness training alongside the compulsive buyers, and they also filled out the questionnaire at the three time points. Okay, so that was the basic design.
Yeah, and well, can we unpack a bit more why people shop compulsively? Could you expand on, say, the emotional role of buying, perhaps with a couple of examples from the participants of the research?
Yeah, sure. So for these participants, buying certainly helped to manage their emotional difficulties. So, for example, there was a high incidence of anxiety and depression within this group, and also in some cases obsessive compulsive disorder. So emotionally they're very fragile, and they have in some ways quite a low tolerance to the very negative emotions. So if they're feeling particularly anxious, they will go shopping because that distracts them. It takes them out of that very negative place. Because to them, shopping gives them a high, and they quite often use those sorts of words, a high or a buzz, a very strong positive feeling, even if it doesn't last very long, it's there. And so that makes them feel good, and so they can manage the much more negative things that are happening in their lives. Even for some of them, just being in a shopping mall, for example, you know, there's an excitement for them. One person described it as being like in a Disney world, where everything's possible and everything sparkles. She used that word. And so it kind of gives you a sense of the very difficult place they're living in their everyday life, that shopping has taken on that role for them. Another example was a participant who, because of her shopping addiction, had landed herself in a huge amount of debt, and she was at risk of losing her house. And the irony was that she couldn't cope with that anxiety for fairly obvious reasons. I'm not sure any of us could that well. But her way of managing that anxiety was to shop even more, which then obviously compounded the debt issue. So there were these cycles of emotion and trying to manage that emotion, but quite often that backfired, which is quite common in addiction.
And then there's these symbolic reasons as well, aren't there?
Yes. So this is quite interesting in terms of actually for all of us, the way that we use material goods for symbolic reasons. So this might be, for example, we all wear certain clothes, we have a certain type of bag, we go on certain types of holidays, and these quite often will say something about who we are as a person. So one participant, she had school-aged children, but she was very, very insecure in her role as a mother. She never felt like she was doing anything well enough. She was very felt very fragile. And so she used consumer goods in order to boost her sense of identity around being a mother. So she had, for example, a kitchen absolutely rammed full of kitchen equipment, because for her that symbolized, I'm supporting my family, I'm feeding my family. She had mountains of clothes, and they were clothes that for her said, well, other mothers wear these types of clothes, so this is what I should be wearing if I'm going to be seen as a good mother. So these were some of the ways that material goods for them were used. Another participant spoke of, she was a little bit overweight, and she said, well, I buy clothes to look slimmer, you know, when I'm in the shop. Then the clothes, it's like they've got magic mirrors. I look slimmer in the shop, because she was so uncomfortable with her sense of herself as being overweight.
Some people buy clothes that are actually smaller than they are, with the hope that they'll get into them at some stage.
Well, certainly one person described buying clothes from a petite range of clothes, and she wasn't petite, and she said she described it, oh, well, maybe that's because I want to be petite.
Yeah.
Yes. And then where does that go? You know, we can't change those basic things about ourselves.
Okay, so the participants then did the intervention. What happened?
It was actually quite extraordinary to see what happened to them. The first thing to say was they were quite desperate, and they were therefore extremely engaged in the course and were very, very committed to doing the home practice, which I think is important to say, because the effects of mindfulness come from the practice, and that applies to all of us. So in terms of what happened, there was kind of a need for them to understand what mindfulness was. They needed to understand what is it they were trying to do, and what was the purpose of that. But that was quite simply explained to them by the teacher, and that was part of what then motivated them to proceed with the course and the home practice.
Yeah.
There was a very big element in terms of outcomes around self-regulation. The irony of having an addiction like this is that you feel out of control, and you use your, in this case, shopping in order to regain a sense of control. But because it's an addiction, you are by definition out of control. You can't control the urges. And what happened with the mindfulness training was a sense of being able to regulate their emotions and their behavior without requiring the shopping to do that. So if we think about emotions, so there's two sides of emotion regulation. We can down-regulate emotions, and we can up-regulate emotions, if you like. So if we talk about up-regulating emotions, then I found with the participants is that they had widened their source of where they could gain positive feelings. So whereas before they thought it's only because I go shopping that I feel good. But for example, one participant spoke about a day out with her children and how in the past she would have been very focused on, at this particular attraction we've gone to, there's a shop at the end, or if I wasn't here, I could be shopping, very consumed by thoughts about shopping. But because she had been through the mindfulness training, she recognized that simply being with her children was in itself a sense of positive feeling. And so she required the shopping less to fulfill that need. And in terms of the down regulation of negative emotions, people said things like, I can feel that anxiety is there, but it's not the whole of who I am. It's not the whole of my experience. And I can just be with that. Or they experience that strong urge. Someone talked about leaving work, and her pattern had been as soon as she left work, she went shopping because she couldn't face going home. So she would sit in the car and she would do a mindfulness practice, and she could recognize that she was experiencing an urge, and she could recognize that that's just an emotion, that's just a feeling, and she could then sort of see past that, if you like, just live that experience but not actually have to follow it through. So that was quite extraordinary when you think that they'd only done this practice for 2 months. It's a relatively short period of time.
Yeah.
And part of how they reached this change in their self-regulation was, and I found this fascinating, the use of metaphor was really crucial for them. Actually having a direct experience, or putting words to the direct experience of their emotions, was too difficult for them. But if they could find a metaphor that would help them to express that, then it became more easily understandable. So, for example, drawing on the John Kabat-Zinn idea, if you like, of the life being like bobbing around on the ocean, and the waves are going to come, but, we all we need to do is learn how to float and how to surf those waves. And those sorts of images and metaphors were really, really helpful for them. And one person said, well, I'm just going to bob around on the ocean then, and could really have a sense of, this is simply my experience in this moment.
Yeah. And presumably they were able to see things from a wider perspective.
Yes, absolutely. Perspective was really crucial. Yes. In all of this. Yeah.
How did they feel at the end then?
Well, I would say that they showed less symptoms of depression and anxiety. They even spoke at times of experiencing moments of joy, which was completely unknown to them beforehand. It wasn't all plain sailing, as in, an addiction doesn't get cured by 8 weeks of mindfulness practice. There was still those urges to be managed, but they felt, I would say, stronger, more confident, and they had a clearer sense of who they were, which I think is really important when we think back to the identity and sense of self as being a driver for consumer behavior. If they are clearer in who they feel themselves to be, then there is less need for them to try to find a sense of identity through consumption. So, for example, one lady said, now when I go to a shop, I know what I like and what I don't like, whereas before I just bought everything.
Right. So she's got more a sense of balance in a sense, or proportion.
Yes, a sense of balance and proportion, and just a clearer sense of who she is as a person, which meant that there was, less need to try and find that through the material goods.
Yeah. Okay. Looking at the chart that showed the results, there was a sharp drop at the beginning in terms of depression, and then there was a bit of a relapse after about 3 months. Now, so although these results are positive and encouraging, then presumably wider social and cultural changes are needed to support these individual efforts. What do you think can be done there?
Yes, it's true that there was a certain amount of relapse. They certainly didn't return to the levels of anxiety and depression from the beginning of the research. But I think in terms of wider support, it's hard. I think it's hard for any of us practicing mindfulness or any kind of meditation. It's hard for all of us to feel day to day that we can keep that motivation going with our practice. And if you're an addict and you're very much feeling at the mercy of these urges and these thoughts and these difficult emotions, then I think sitting down every day to meditate is an awful lot to ask.
Sure, yeah.
So in terms of a wider societal change, I mean, I think it would be really, really helpful to have a wider support network for people once they have, for example, done the 8-week training, and then the 8-week training ends, and then suddenly people are kind of like, well, now what do I do? So I think that would be really helpful. And for this group particularly, for a group of addicts, I think ongoing support of the practice is crucial. But also it would be really helpful if there was a wider societal value placed on the types of things that mindfulness is offering. So that present moment experience, that present moment being with oneself, and then the kind of values, or if you like, not necessarily values, the aspects that develop from the mindfulness practice, which might be around ethics and morals, for example. If that was more valued in society, then it might be easier for people to retain that kind of ongoing practice.
Yeah, sure. Do you think it's starting to happen? You know, there are several projects out there now to get mindfulness, for example, in schools, or you can get the 8-week mindfulness MBSR course now through your GP potentially. Do you think it's starting to happen, although we've got a long way to go?
Yes, I do think it's starting to happen, and I think it's really, really encouraging that is starting to happen, particularly in schools. You know, if we can introduce these concepts to children, you know, they're growing up quite often in very high stress environments, and so it can not only be helpful for them in managing the pressures that they grow up with, but also you're planting the seeds. You know, as a mindfulness instructor myself, I see that a lot of my job is simply planting seeds. I'm planting these seeds in people's consciousness and awareness so that they can then choose whether they develop them or not. And if we're planting those seeds in young people, then who knows when that seed might germinate, but at some point it may well do so.
Yeah, okay. How do your findings potentially relate to sustainability and consumption on a larger scale?
Well, I think that in thinking about compulsive buying as being on a spectrum with, if you like, normal buying, and I'm not very keen on labelling things that way, and I'm not very keen on having turns compulsive buying into a pathology, but nonetheless the labels can help us to explain it. And I think if we're seeing these changes in emotion regulation, in behavioral regulation, and in people's sense of themselves and more confident in their sense of themselves, leading to less reliance on consumer goods and behaviours to fulfil those things, then that can apply to all of us.
Yeah.
Very definitely. It's not limited to the shopping addict. And I think that if that's the case, then there will surely be a reduction in our overall need for new things if we are applying our mindfulness practice, so that we can regulate our emotions without needing to go shopping. And that applies to all of us, not just the compulsive buyer. And if we can have a clearer sense of who we are, or the alternative is if we start to break down a fixed sense of our identity, then all of these things, if they are managed through a meditation practice, then we don't need consumer goods. So I think there is a general lesson to be learned for all of us around our consumption levels. And that, of course, will automatically lead on to leading us to a more sustainable lifestyle if we are not requiring so much in the way of material goods.
You touched on ethics a minute ago, Alison. Maybe you could just expand on that a bit more. And is there anything else in the present general understanding of mindfulness that you would modify?
I think in having taken mindfulness out of its Buddhist context, we run the risk of losing something. And I'm not necessarily saying that we should only practice mindfulness if we're also a Buddhist, because I think mindfulness has an awful lot to offer in a secular context. But I think the loss of an ethical or moral framework is a real shame. And there is sort of this implication in mindfulness that if we do enough practice, the ethics and morals will develop anyway, which may well be the case. But I think given that we're increasingly under pressure in terms of our environment and seeking a sustainable way to live, I think that it would be helpful for mindfulness to be more explicit about the ethical and moral framework that it is advocating.
Yeah.
And I also, my understanding of the translation of the Pali word sati into being mindfulness, I think we've also lost two or three elements. We've lost sometimes, not always, but sometimes we've lost the element of heart and compassion. We also sometimes have lost the sense of self-reliance that is part of the sense of the word in the Sati language. And I think that sometimes mindfulness, in the way it's currently being taught, doesn't emphasize enough the idea of embodiment. I think that embodying our experience, embodying our emotions, is absolutely fundamental to our healing of difficult emotions, but also our ability to be in the world and operating well within the world. So I think that the concept of embodiment and the experience of embodiment could be emphasized a little bit more.
Do you think a more appropriate term would be mind-bodyfulness or heartfulness? Or
yes, mind, body and heartfulness, yes.
Okay. Yes. My last question then, Alison, what is your understanding of the middle way and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
I find it really interesting in what your group is doing. I like the fact that you're resisting getting involved in dogma, which I think is really important, allowing people to find their route
yeah.
with the different aspects of living rather than just taking some other version of it. I know that you touch on the ideas of embodiment within what you're doing. And so obviously with me having just stated how key I think that is, then I think that it's very related. And I think that the exploration of the sort of widening of a circle of moral concern and the confidence to explore our pro-social and pro-environmental values without dogma and without too much in the way of being rigid in our definitions, I think is really helpful. And although I did have to be a little bit rigid in my definitions to satisfy the criteria of doing a PhD, I did feel that it was restrictive in some ways to do that, and that I think it's more helpful to be open to other interpretations. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Alison. It's been really interesting and informative and a real pleasure.
Okay, you're very welcome, Barry. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.